Today's Teisho will be case 7 in the Hekigan Roku, the Pien Ru. Case 7 is entitled Hogen's You Are Echo. Engo's introduction. As to what stands prior to the word, not one phrase has been handed down, even by the thousand holy ones. If you are not yet intimate with it, you are separated from it by the 3,000 worlds. Even if you have attained some understanding of it and could stop the mouths of people living in the world, you are not yet worthy to be called clear-eyed. That is why it is said that heaven cannot cover it, earth cannot hold it, space cannot accommodate it, sun and moon cannot shine on it. When there is no Buddha, and when you are alone, when you alone are the master, then for the first time you are worthy of being talked about a little. Now, if you are not like that yet, you have yet to become enlightened in relation to the slightest object and give out illumination yourself. Then you can go anywhere and enjoy perfect freedom in your Dharma activity. Whatever you take up, you act rightly. Tell me, how could you achieve such a freedom? Once again I ask you, do you understand this? None hitherto had noticed the sweat of his steed, but his merits must be recognized. Now, what is Secho's koan? See below. Main subject, main koan. A monk said to Hogen, "My name is Echo. I ask you, what is the Buddha?" Hogen said, "You are Echo." Secho's verse, "In the land of the river, faintly stirring, the gentle breeze of spring, far away, deep among blossoms, the partridge sings. Ascending the falls, the carp became a dragon, yet still by night, fools fish for him below." So this is the last day of our winter 2010 sesshin, and everybody did a marvelous job this morning. The Zendo was so still. I know that some of you are sick and struggling with that. One of our members actually was just wiped out and had to leave, and so I know that that's a challenge. But people really sat beautifully this morning, like rocks. It was really wonderful to see. And it's a great pleasure and honor to practice with everybody here. People come to sesshin usually because they are looking for something, you know, in life. And it's hard to say, you know, what we're looking for. I think in my case, I was looking for an end to suffering, you know. I was really having a lot of trouble with many things in my life, you know. And I couldn't really afford to go to a therapist, so I went to a Tibetan center in Seattle, and it was an interesting place. It was very, like so many Tibetan places, it was beautiful, you know. The colors, the building was, it was an old bungalow, Seattle-style bungalow, but they had painted it yellow and it had red trim, so it was very Tibetan. And there were prayer flags out front, very inviting, you know. Inside, the colors again were sort of like a beautiful sunrise yellow, and the cushions were all burgundy, so it was very pretty, very bright. And but there was no resident teacher there. I would just go there, and I had read by that time I had read some books on Buddhism, and I had read some these wonderful books by Chogyam Trungpa, And so that's how I found out about this. Trungpa established a network of centers, meditation centers. And this was one of them in Seattle. There was one branch in Seattle. So I went to this, but there were no resident teachers. And I was meditating there one day, and I ran into a person who said, you know, there's a Japanese Zen master who's just come to Seattle. His name is Genki Roshi. So I went to see Genki Roshi, and I was so impressed I decided to do Zazen, you know. And I was his student for many years. My relationship with Genki Roshi was complicated. I was suffering a lot, and I didn't know why. I didn't know exactly what was making me so unhappy. In retrospect, I realized that I was a little bit depressed, you know, or actually I think in college generally I had struggled with some depression. And then after college, I think on and off I would be depressed, you know. And I didn't really know why, but when I started to do Zazen, I felt much better. Really, it really helped. I realize now, now in retrospect, I realize why I was depressed. I mean, I could list a long list of causes. My parents had like a terrible relationship. My father had a drinking problem. I could go on and on. My dad and I had a tense relationship, and he was very critical of me, and so on and so on. But strangely, if you had asked me then, I'm not sure I would have said, I'm depressed, you know. And I don't think I would have known why. If I finally said, gee, maybe I'm... I mean, this was before depression became a common idea in the culture. You know, now the diagnosis of depression is quite widespread. But back then, basically people just self-medicated with doobies and joints, you know. And as did I, as a little bit. You know. But I think I was depressed. And I actually think marijuana is depressive, actually. I think it actually can make you depressed. And I was never a big pothead, you know. But I think I was depressed. But if somebody had asked me, why am I depressed, I don't think I could have said. I don't think I would have said, well, my parents have a terrible relationship, you know, I'm alone. I don't have very many friends, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think I would have said any of those things. And I think it was because I didn't allow myself to see those things. Because then I would have been really scared, you know. I was an English major. I'd gotten out of college with a BA in English. And it was hard for me to get a decent job. And I wasn't very creative. You know, I could have gone over to Boeing maybe and gotten a job as a technical writer. And when I went to graduate school, many of my friends got jobs at Boeing as technical writers, and they've had wonderful lives, you know. Usually they want people with an advanced degree or a degree in technical writing, which I didn't have, you know. I was doing sort of menial jobs, and I was drifting along, and I was unhappy, but I didn't know why. And if somebody had said, why are you unhappy, I don't think I could have said. And it was because I wouldn't have let myself, I didn't let myself see, you know, what might be making me unhappy. And, you know, this is a common phenomenon, you know. We draw the curtain over things that frighten us, and we try to keep the curtain closed. And this is like a coping mechanism, right? Because, you know, there's a certain way of thinking that's quite frightening, you know. So if you open the curtain and you see, you know, I'm lonely because, you know, all I ever saw were bad relationships. I'm headed for a dead-end job because I didn't get the right education. I'm one of 275 million Americans. I'm one of 6 billion human beings, you know. It gets to be terrifying. You think, my God, you know, I'm just like a little speck. I'm a little, you know, speck blowing in the wind, you know, like dust in the wind. So you know, we keep the curtain closed. You know, we go to movies where, you know, there's a guy like Rambo who, you know, jumps out of helicopters and, you know, mows down a whole bunch of people, and we kind of identify, you know, we say, yeah, I'm that kind of guy, you know, right? Isn't that right? You know, or the Dirty Harry, you know, or just the, you know, Beverly Hills Cop, you know, the guy who bucks the system and, you know, always does his individual thing and never lets anything frighten him, you know, he's, you know, those are our fantasies, you know, but actually, you know, we draw the curtain because it is a way of thinking about things. It's scary, you know, and it's frightening, right? So I wouldn't have been able to say because I kept the curtain closed, this is a very human thing to do. But the problem was that I couldn't really understand why I was so unhappy, and then I began to do Zen, you know, and Zen for me was really liberating. I felt better after sitting, probably than I had ever felt in my life. Now, you know, like everybody else, I had a lot of pain in my legs. I would go to sesshin, and I can remember some sesshin where it was just like every sit I was struggling with pain. I would come back from sesshin and, you know, but I'd get up the next day and I'd feel so good, you know. It was the darndest thing, you know. Like I was in pain the whole time, but I had the sweetest mind. It was like my mind was sweet and clear, and I felt optimistic and hopeful and energized, you know, less... Like, you know, normally people who have, like, depression problems, it's like they're dragging around a bunch of chains all the time, you know? And so there's, like, this heavy weight on you. And there's kind of heaviness to everything. And when I would come back from sesshin, I was sort of light-hearted, you know, light. And I felt spacious, you know? And it wasn't like, you know, a miracle transformation, but it was different. You know, it felt good to be free. I had these ideas about Zen and meditation that came from the things I had read, you know. So I've talked about this before, but, I grew up on military bases, which are among the dullest places in the universe, you know, because you have all these people who aren't very, you know, just, they're brilliant people in the armed forces, but you know, generally speaking, you know, the people in the Army, the Navy, and the Marines are not really imaginative people, you know. So military bases are not like fascinating places to be, you know. Especially kids, you know, there's very little for kids to do. It's not a world created for kids. Military people have kids, and they're off doing their thing. In those days, there were the fathers, generally speaking, were in the military, and the mothers took care of the house, you know. So the military base was a very drab place, and in fact, even today, kids who grew up in those kinds of environments have a lot of problems, like with crime and drug addiction. So it was very colorless place, and I got into reading, and I like to read science fiction, and I would read National Geographic, and the thing that always used to catch my eye were these stories on mystical Tibet, you know. And maybe that's why I went to a Dharma Datu center in Seattle, but you know, basically there'd be these stores, and you'd look and there were these cool buildings like nothing in the United States. You know, the Tibetans build their houses on the tops of mountains to save the flat land for agriculture. So in America, we pick the best agricultural land, we put a house on it, right? At development, and destroy it. In most cultures, they think, no, that has to be protected. Put the house on the hill that can't be farmed, right? So the Tibetans have these houses on mountains that look, you know, they're big pieces of rock, and then they build their house on top of it. And partly it's for defense, you know, because it was a rough neighborhood. And partly it was, you know, this idea of keeping the best land open for barley and things like that, because there wasn't much good land, you know. But it was so cool. These houses were so cool. And then they'd have pictures of, you know, the temple inside, and it was like nothing. It was not, it's like nothing you'd see, like, in an American church or synagogue. It was this, you know, there were these incredible colors and these banners hanging down from the ceiling. And there would be these mystical monks in there with these, you know, burgundy robes or these bright red robes. And then I also read these incredible novels by Lobsang Rampa, who was this who claimed he had been, he was later exposed as a total and utter fraud, you know. But he claimed to be a Tibetan. He wasn't. He was from Europe. I think he was a Hungarian or something like that, you know. And he invented this mystical world of Tibet where, you know, monks could telepathically communicate with each other. And, you know, basically you'd send a message, Genki, are you there? Yes. You know, how are you today? Good. You know, while you're sitting on the cushion. Right? And also the monks could fly with, he said that monks could fly huge distances with these giant kites, you know. Really, this was all part of this guy's personal mythology of Tibet. And people have written a lot of books on how Westerners have fantasized Tibet, you know. And I certainly did. I just thought, you know, this is a mystical realm. And the truth is, if people are unhappy enough, they'll believe almost anything that makes them feel better. It's just a truth, you know. When you look at the world's religions, you know, a lot of them say things that are just crazy, you know. And it's easy to say, well, how could anybody believe that? You know, how could anybody believe that, you know? But, you know, if you're in enough pain, things can feel very liberating, you know, that goes for Zen too, you know. So I came into, the world of Zen in a lot of pain, and I didn't even know, I didn't really even let myself know it fully, I guess. And I began to do meditation, and I began to feel better, and I began to have a lot of fantasies about mystical initiations and things like that. So this sounds crazy, you know, but actually, you know, millions of people think this way, you know. There are stores all over the United States, and I'm not really trying to make fun of people. There are stores all over the United States that are called New Age stores. And if you go in, they have like candles shaped like the Buddha. They have candles shaped like the Buddha. They have candles shaped like naked women. They have candles, you know, shaped like a witch, you know, all next to each other. There's like crystals hanging down, you know, and other glass items. They might find bongs in there, you know. So they're a strange place, you know. And at one time, you know, if you went in there, you could buy a pyramid and put it on your head, you know. Really, I mean, there's, and again, you can think, this is so ridiculous. But, But people, if you look at a crystal, it's beautiful, it reflects the light, it might make you feel more relaxed. But we all have this tendency to fantasize. We live in a crazy world a lot of the time. Sometimes it's okay, but sometimes it's just crazy. It can be a little bit scary. If one out of every five Americans, there's one job for every five unemployed Americans, that's scary. And it might be the case that one out of every five Americans is either unemployed or underemployed. So that's scary. And if you see a New Age shop, at first you might, I too think, ha ha, this is crazy. But then you begin to realize, gee, people are really scared, and they're looking for sources of reassurance in things like my dream of mystical Tibet, And so I got into Zen because, first of all, it really did make me feel better for reasons I did not understand, and also because I had these fantasies about escaping from my environment. And when I went to I finally went to graduate school in English because I realized that moving furniture was not a great career. So, I didn't want to move furniture, and I didn't want to be a chef. Having run a restaurant and working like 80-hour weeks, I realized I like to cook, but this is too tough, So basically, I just couldn't see any... And also, I knew people in the food industry, and they really were worn out, A lot of them had drinking problems. Just to elaborate on this, it is true if you work in a restaurant, you often put in these incredible hours. You might have to get there at like 9 in the morning and get the food ready for lunch, and then you get like a 2 or 3 hour lunch off break, and then you come back and you get ready for dinner. You might not be done until midnight. You have empty dining hall, and then all of a sudden people all come in, because they know it's 7 o'clock, it's time for the restaurant to open, or 6 o'clock, maybe it's six, 20 people come in, but by seven, you've got 100 people in the room, and they're all ordering different things, and you're putting them in the oven, and you're taking them out, and, waitresses come in with their order, and there's usually like this little wheel, and they say, I'm hanging. Two manicotti, lasagna, and a sirloin, a medium rare. And you've got to put this, you're scrambling around, then the next waitress. And so you've got an oven full of stuff, and they come in and they hang, they order, then they take the salad, and then they get the drinks, and then they're going to come back and pick up. And you're supposed to have, when they say, I'm picking up, you go to the oven and you pull out the lasagna, you pull out the manicotti, the steak is ready, and you've got to make sure all these things are coming out at the same time. And if you screw up, it screws everything up. So, you pull out, the waitress says, I'm pulling, and it was two manicotti, not one, and you put one in. So then you take a manicotti from the next order, but you're a manicotti short. So you've got to get that in the oven, and you're just hoping that the waitress who placed the most recent manicotti doesn't come in. Because she'll come in and go, I'm pulling a manicotti, and what you're supposed to do is stick your finger in the manicotti to see if it's hot. And if it's still cool, you can't serve it, right? And so then you say to the waitress, it's not quite done, and she thinks, how the hell did that happen, right? And that means she's not going to get her tip, and she's very mad at you, right? And so cooks defend themselves by being very aggressive to the waitresses. It can create it's like preemptive aggression, right? The chef in the restaurant where I used to work, he just said, get out of here, get out. He was very, Bill Garrison was his name, and he died of a heart attack. Really, he died of a heart attack. The stress is just so anyway, I would love someday to have a restaurant where, you know, basically I could cook and make wonderful food for my friends and you know, a no stress environment. But it's not like that usually in the commercial restaurant world. So I thought, that's it, you know, I want to do something else. So I went into graduate school because I was good in English. And I got into graduate school, but it was very competitive. And, you know, I was, people were reading Heidegger, and I thought, I don't even understand one word of this, you know. and you know, there were people who spoke Italian and German, and they were very intellectual. They were reading, you know, and they seemed to know so much. You know, I would come into these classes, and people would say, you know, well, this, as Lacan says, or as Freud says, you know, I thought, oh, I'll never catch up. And so I felt so overwhelmed, you know. And so, you know, this was another reason that, you know, I just thought, get me out of here, get me to Tibet right away, you know. Get me out of here, you know. Because I didn't want to go back to the restaurant world, because I just thought, you know, that is one heck of, I mean, if food is your passion, you know, okay, go to the Culinary Institute, go and be, you know, and then, you know, be prepared for long days, you know. But it wasn't my passion, so I went to graduate school and I felt overwhelmed in graduate school. So I got into Zen and I was hoping, you know, and I really, even though it's so childish, it's as childish as those crystals, you know, that hang up in, and those candles with the Buddha candles, you know. I thought really and truly that, you know, I had this fantasy, I guess. It's not like a real belief, but I had a fantasy that somehow I was going to go into see Genki Roshi and he was going to give me like the mystical initiation, you know. And it would be like, you know, he'd say, do this, you know, visualize red, now, you know, do this, and then boom, you know, and it would be like pain-free living, right, you know, and everything would go my way, you know, again, there's a curtain you draw, right, you don't want to look behind the curtain, but you keep it closed enough to function, you know, so behind the curtain were all my fears. Heidegger was hiding behind the curtain, and the Italian language, Italy was behind the curtain, and so on. And I was so afraid, you know. But I didn't really let myself see that, or I would have just quit graduate school. And so I was sort of like between a rock and a hard place, you know. And I was hoping Genki Roshi would give me mystical instructions and I would be out of my pain and have no more challenges in life, you know. And yet, you know, actually, it's very true that you can't really get out of your pain unless you can see it, you know, unless you can see it. But it's very hard to see what's so, sometimes it's hard to see what's so obvious, you know, because we draw the curtain, you know. Sometimes the most obvious thing is the most difficult to see. Now, you know, if you do Zen practice, there's many different kinds of koans, you know. Some koans are really about these alternative states of consciousness that are quite astonishing. You know, there really are such states. And we don't normally encounter them because we stay in a very narrow range of experiences. Because, you know, habit, culture, also, you know, it's safe. So some koans are really about like these alternate realities. I mean, they're real, but they're alternate forms of consciousness. You encounter reality in a different way, you know. But some koans are really about, you know, like encountering everyday reality just as it is, but looking at what we don't want to see because we've drawn the curtain, you know. And that's very, very hard work. You know, some of these koans are really very hard work because, you know, on the one hand, we're trying to, we want an awakenness, which means opening the curtain. On the other hand, we're terrified of opening the curtain, right? You know, so it's like being in a tug of war with yourself. You know, a koan trainee can have this quality of being in a tug of war with yourself. And part of the reason for doing Zen might be to get out of pain. And of course, that's why we keep the curtain closed, to stay away from our pain. But sometimes there's no way to get away from the pain. You have to go through the pain. I don't mean you have to go through pain. I mean you have to pass through the pain. And that means opening the curtain. So not all koans are quite like this, but there's some koans that are like this, where you're trying to pull the curtain open, but on the other hand, you're desperately trying to keep it shut. And so you're sort of playing a little game with yourself, yeah? And so, the truth is that reality is very, very difficult for people to encounter. Because we're human beings, and one of the ways we deal with reality is to create a kind of a curtain of fantasy and projection around ourselves. And it's not just us as individuals, it's the whole culture, you know. I mean, not just this culture, but culture, you know. If you go to other cultures, you see the strangest things, right, you know. If you went to Saudi Arabia, you'd see women who, like, literally in bags as they walk down the street, you know. They don't even want, you know, you're not, in some cultures, you can't even see a woman's eyes. Even the eyes are concealed behind, like, a net. In some cultures,
there's cultures where different people are graded into different levels. And you don't want to run into somebody at the wrong level, or it could cause you to be unclean in some way. There are all kinds of cultures like this that are so weird. And when we go there to these places and we see this stuff, we think, man, thank God our culture is normal, right? Right? Like, I'm sure glad I'm not in Saudi Arabia. You know, thank God a good old USA is safe, right? Unfortunately, we have no culture here, as we all know. So we are totally natural here in America. So, that is a fantasy, right? I mean, we have created like a dream world. And when we look back on the past, we see it, right? You know, you look at hula hoops. Do you know what a hula hoop is? When I was a kid, there was a company called the Whammo Company, and they started producing these weird things like the hula hoop, and they would get some little girl to be on Ed Sullivan's show, and she'd do her hula routine, and then suddenly, like, 20 million kids had to have a hula hoop, you know. And they would buy them, and all you could do was put it around your waist and wiggle your waist to keep it in the air. And, you know, not being, any normally intelligent person would find that interesting for about 2 days, right? You know? So you would get your hula hoop, oh my God, a hula hoop, this is so cool. And then you go, nit, 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 you know? And then you realize, this is really stupid, you know. And then there'd be garages full of hula hoops, right? You know, but then, right? This is how America works, right? So this is like the consumer culture. So it's totally weird. It's as weird as seeing people with rings in their noses. You know, it's just our weirdness looks normal. You know, So basically, you know, we tend to draw the curtain as individuals and as a culture, and it's very, very hard to see reality for what it is. So
You know, it took me a long time, it took a lot of Zen practice, before I could see some of the things that were frightening me, you know. But when the odd thing is that when I confronted some of these things, I did feel much better, you know. And it's not, so a lot of Zen, some of Zen practice is, you know, trying to see something that you're conditioning, just won't let you see. There's this alternative state of consciousness that you're trying to enter, and you hit it by accident, you know. But some of Zen practice is trying to take the curtain back and find out what is really behind our motives, you know, what is really behind our actions, rather, and. Or what's really behind our fears, you know? I used to have a friend who was obsessed with money, you know? He used to say things like, someday I'm going to be very rich, you know? And who knows, he probably is very rich, you know? I don't know, I haven't kept in touch with him, but he used to say, I'm going to be very successful. I'm going to be very rich. He'd say this all the time. It was really funny, you know. He worked in the restaurant business, as a matter of fact. His name was Mike Mercer. He was a fraternity boy, you know, in college. And he got out of college and he had a big fraternity ring on his finger. And he bought like a Porsche. I'm sure he spent every dime he had on that Porsche because he was a manager in a restaurant, you know. And so he wasn't making like the big bucks, but he had this idea. And he would say it all the time. He said, boy, you watch, I'm going to be rich, you know. And another way to hear that is to hear him say, I'm afraid, you know, I'm afraid. I feel like powerless, you know, I feel like nobody, you know. So, he may or may not be rich today, but one way to hear it is to think, you know, this guy is an egomaniac, you know, but another way to hear it is to realize this is somebody who's really scared he's going to be powerless, you know. And by the way, he was a weightlifter, right, also. That just goes one time we arm wrestled and he crushed me in like a second, right? And by the way, I used to weigh a lot more than I used to weigh about 20 pounds more than I do now, and I had real muscles once, you know. So I wasn't as flimsy as I am now, but he just went and it was just another sign that he was going to be very successful, you know. But the thing is that you know, he was big and strong, and he had a Porsche, and he was destined for the top, but, you know, one way to hear what he was saying is, I'm very scared, you know. So Zen is about taking back the curtain, but, you know, that could be very frightening if all we did was take back the curtain. But, you know, there's this other aspect of Zen practice, which is, you know, when we do Zen, we begin to have this feeling of, serenity, calm, centeredness, rootedness. We begin to have this feeling of sometimes connectedness, you know. You begin to feel at ease in life, at ease in the world. And it's, instead of being like a clenched fist, you're like an open hand a little bit. And it's like you can move easily through the world, you know. It's like you can walk easily. And you might notice, you know, I'm not as tense as I was. I'm not as frightened. And this world seems to be a better place. And it seems to be like a home to me. And at a deeper level, you can experience the world as like part of yourself. That takes a lot of practice. Some of you have had experiences where you've been listening to something like a bird and you just feel totally unified with the bird. Or one of the people I talked about earlier went walking in the woods and she said she just felt like everything was alive, you know. And if that hasn't happened to you yet, don't worry. Please don't try to have that experience. Just try to be in the moment. But little by little, you know, when you stay in the moment, you begin, you know, just in the moment, you begin to feel a little better.
you begin to feel a little calmer, and you begin to have a little more trust in the world, you know. From one standpoint, in a certain way, being one human being among 7 billion human beings is a terrifying prospect. You know, you turn on the TV and somebody's starving and everybody goes, ho ho, you know, what else is on, you know. It's terrifying to see that, you know, the starving part, and also the indifference is terrifying, right? But on the other hand, you know, when you experience the world, there's a different way to experience the world, you know. You develop a trusting mind. And the trusting mind, that's very hard to achieve, but it's not a fantasy. It's not a curtain, I'm convinced, you know. Everything is one life. Everything is one life. And actually, if we all felt that everything was part of ourselves, we wouldn't let people starve. We wouldn't. It's only because of our separateness that we look on them with such indifference, you know. You can't feed everybody on earth, but sometimes life presents you with opportunities to help others, and you can be genuinely helpful. If you're concerned about people, not having enough to eat, if you can make some kind of a modest contribution. And you might think, well, this is just, you know, $20, this is just $100. But, if enough people do that, that's all you can do as an individual. But, you can make a difference. You know, when you, you know, one person in our group told me, that she got, what did she say? She got on the bus and she saw, or she was walking down the street and she saw somebody's face and she felt like she was looking at her own face. She just felt full of love for this person whom she didn't even know. And you know, if you do enough zazen, you begin to have experiences like that, you know. You begin to feel connected to the world. Now, normally, we're so scared, we don't want to be connected, we want to be protected. But sometimes, you know, if you do enough zazen, you begin to feel safer in the world, and you begin to have this sense of connectedness. And, you know, it's like you let your guard down, but you're not destroyed, right? And you begin to feel that maybe this prospect of being alive is kind of good, you know? So, at the same time that Zen is sometimes asking you to open the curtain, it's giving you this sense of connection, this sense of safety. And so then, when you feel safe enough, you can open the curtain and you can look and you can say, "Oh my gosh, you know, I see now, you know." And that can be very liberating, you know. Not all koans are like that, but some are. But in almost every case, the problem, the reason we don't see things as they are is because we're afraid, you know. Even these states of alternative, some people, first time they encounter mu, they flip out, you know. Fortunately, the first time I encountered mu, I thought it was the coolest damn thing that had ever happened, you know. It was like my mind went totally blank. And it was like time, you know, it says, wow, that is the coolest thing, you know. But there are people who have that experience and they just think, oh my God, that is really frightening. It's like walking into an ocean at night. You know, there could be a shark in there, you know, who knows, you could be swept away by a wave. And some people have very palpable physical reactions, you know, like anxiety. So, if you stay with that blankness long enough, the anxiety goes away and you realize this is really a wonderful place to be. But even mu can be rather scary. You have to learn to trust mu, you know, learn to trust mu, one with the trusting mind. Yeah. A monk asked Hogen, "My name is Echo. I ask you, what is the Buddha?" Hello, my name is Hogen. What is the Buddha? Now, you know, the average person's response is money, you know, fame. The average person's response might be the Dalai Lama. The average person's response might be, you know, the Buddha dwells in the seventh heaven, you know, and is made of celestial crystals, you know. The Buddha is beyond time and space, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And dwells in, you know, Tushita heaven, you know, Tushita heaven. Those are all ways of drawing the curtain, right? The Buddha lives in Tibet, the Buddha, you know. But, you know, basically, Hogen has been doing a lot of Zazen. And so even though, you know, the world can be a little bit of an unnerving place, a little bit of a scary place, he's developed the trusting mind. And so, you know, what he says is, he actually, you know, the guy says, my name is Hogen, or my name is Echo. I ask you, what is Buddha? And Hogen says, you are Echo. This moment is Buddha. This moment is Buddha. What's actually here is Buddha. And this could sound, you know, this could sound, well, of course what's here is Buddha, but, you know, in our lives, it's very difficult for us to achieve that simplicity, that honesty and simplicity. You know, humans are, you know, often people who do a lot of Zazen develop great compassion and ability to empathize with others, but typically, you know, I'll never forget my roommate, Larry Sullivan, fell in love with this woman in college, and he was head over heels in love with her, and it didn't work out, and I think he became depressed, you know, and he was a doper, if I may say so, you know, so he always, his idea of a good day was to have a glass of wine, a joint, and listen to his records, you know, that was the end of his day, he spent a lot of time listening, you know, in that state at one time. He had had this difficult relationship, and it just didn't work out. And he was really devastated. You know, I think he even cried. You know, and I had never had that experience, so I just thought, you know, what the hell? What's that all about, right? And I kind of felt like, get a grip, man. You know. And of course, then it happened to me. You know, it's trivial until it happens to me, right? You know, but when it happens to me, it's a terrible emergency for the universe. Right? But that's how it feels. The whole world is falling apart. Can't you see it? You know. So it's easy to look past other people's discomfort because we're not really in it. You know. But when it's our discomfort, it's quite horrible, and it seems like everything's falling. The world is coming to an end, and that's not a fantasy in it entirely. I mean, our world could be coming to an end. You know. So I'm not ridiculing this, but being in it is very different from seeing it from a distance, you know. But Zen is all about stepping out of that self-centered perspective and entering this bigger frame of reference, you know, a bigger mind. And then, you know, you kind of can have on your own unhappiness the perspective of a friend who it has a little distance, you know. You suddenly realize, oh, the world isn't coming to an end. I just feel rejected and unlovable, you know. And just seeing that can be very liberating. Because, you know, you can be your own best friend if you do this long enough. And everybody needs friends. It's very hard for people to admit their own vulnerability sometimes, to see their own fears and their own frailties and dependency on other humans, you know. But when you confront these things on the cushion, when you can find the courage to do it, it can be really liberating. You somehow feel much better. So anyway, we have some
hours left to do our practice. You know, please, everybody's doing a beautiful job. Everybody's really working with their koans. This time the big mind has helped me to give a teisho that I probably won't have to issue any retractions for. So everything's going pretty well. You know, this is precious time to liberate ourselves from our fears and attachments. And let's use it, continue to use it, and we'll have a better life.